From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The trial in 1925 of a Tennessee public school teacher for telling his students about evolution was talked about at the time as the trial of the century. And talk about a circus. 200 journalists were there to see the firebrand William Jennings Bryan face off against the brilliant lawyer Clarence Darrow. There were newsreel crews. It was the first radio network hookup to broadcast the trial to millions. There were monkeys there, too. The historian Jeffrey Moran says it seemed like everyone who owned a monkey in the South showed up at the trial to see if humans evolved, you know, from monkeys. Moran says the trial went less for the humans. It became a battle over culture and religion and class. He's joining us today to tell the story behind the Scopes trial after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So you know the basics in the Scopes trial of 1925, sometimes called the Scopes monkey trial, because it was a trial about whether human beings had descended from a lower order of animals, evolution, basically. For the American Civil Liberties Union, it was a test case to challenge this Tennessee law that made it a crime to teach any theory that denied the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible. That's language in the law. The defendant was a 24-year-old school teacher named John Thomas Scopes. He agreed to be the guinea pig. He allowed himself to be arrested for teaching evolution in his classroom. The people of Dayton, Tennessee, thought this would put them on the map, but really it just made them look like credulous fools. Today in the program, we're talking about the story behind the trial, how it didn't really work out the way anyone thought it would. Our guest is Jeffrey Moran. He's a professor of history at the University of Kansas, and he joined us from Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. Moran says the story erupted out of tectonic shifts in American culture.
Well, one of the major themes that we see, one of the great shifts in American culture in the early 20th century is, in fact, science, bureaucracy, secular life taking over largely from religion. I mean, we shouldn't overestimate the death of religion because, as we know, it remained a pretty powerful force throughout the 20th century. But in the 1920s, we really do see kind of the Protestant establishment in America losing some of its primacy in American culture. And it's losing it to popular culture, it's losing it to Catholics and Jews, and it's losing it simply to people who no longer pay attention to any religions. And that's a really radical shift away from something that was absolutely central to American culture for the previous 200 years.
It's interesting how much this anti-evolution impulse or movement or whatever we want to call it, how much of its fervor it got from this reaction to what was happening in popular culture. People were seeing, you know, jazz, you know, the jazz era was kicking in and there was, you know, movies and all this kinds of stuff. And in some ways, they were kind of blaming Darwin for all of this, it seems.
That's right, although he was pretty distant from the Charleston and everything else. But, it's sort of they were observing these massive changes and cast about for a cause or a scapegoat, as the case may have been. And we hear this today as well, like, why are people misbehaving? Well, they've left God behind, and so they have no moral compass anymore.
Yeah.
And for the 1920s, as more and more young people were going to high school and learning about evolution in the better biology classes, people could make the argument, certainly Bryan made the argument, that it was these biology classes that led students to question the Bible and from there led them into the kinds of dancing and necking and petting and drinking that are the inevitable result of leaving Genesis behind.
A lot of rural resentment. The city is on the rise. Urbanization is something that's just coming to the fore, and this is an issue here.
One of the things that we see is that in 1920, for the first time, the U.S. Census reported that more people were living in urban areas than were living in rural areas. Now, their definition of urban is not quite what we would recognize. It's, I think, if you lived in a town of 1,600 or more people, they considered that to be an urban area. But in fact, the culture was shifting away from Americans considering themselves to be a nation of yeoman farmers and Jeffersonians to people taking some pride in being townspeople, people taking pride in living in the cities. And I note in the book that The New Yorker begins publication in 1925, and The New Yorker was quite proud of the fact that it was not being written for the little old lady in Dubuque, but rather was being written for the urban sophisticates that you would find in Manhattan. And that's pretty different from the 19th century, where the cities were considered to be the dens of iniquity, the places where farm boys went to lose their innocence, intentionally or unintentionally.
Right. It's interesting how the Ku Klux Klan is reborn at this time, as you put it in the book, reassert a kind of dominance of white Protestant leadership.
Right. The Ku Klux Klan really picks up again. There have been several iterations, but it was most popular in the 1920s, more popular than it was in the 1870s, more popular than the 1950s. And a lot of that comes from their defense of Protestant morality. That's one of these things that is hard for us to think of today, but wives sometimes would call the Ku Klux Klan to discipline their husbands who had been having affairs. Mm-hmm. Klan members would go and patrol the parks to make sure young people weren't necking or petting, as they said in the parlance of the time. And so they could see themselves as defenders of the same morality that in some ways William Jennings Bryan and others claimed also to be defending. In fact, the Klan published occasional articles about the importance of fundamentalism and worried about the Scopes trial because it was actually creating some dissent within Protestants. But the Klan knew which side they stood on.
Yeah. But how did their racial ideas, their ideas of racial purity, fit into that?
Well, the Klan, in some ways, had their Baroque racial views in part because they didn't know how to talk about class. So you can think about the Klan as being middling people, sort of shopkeepers in particular. And so when they tried to think of class, they didn't have a language for it. They didn't really have a language for the upper class or for the working class because they thought of themselves as being the only kinds of Americans, middle class. And so when they tried to talk about the rich, they talked about Jews. When they tried to talk about the working class, they talked about sometimes the Catholics, more often African Americans. And these fit in with an older strain of American prejudice, but really took on new energy in the 1920s with the middling classes of America feeling a little bit compressed from above and from below.
We don't need to spend too much time on this, but I'm really intrigued by this idea that in some ways, and I'm wondering if you can apply it to the racism that we're seeing in the 21st century, that in some ways it's not just about race, but it's because we have an inability to talk about class. Can you extend the argument to today at all?
I think so. I mean, leaving aside the Ku Klux Klan.
Of course.
I think even the working classes have difficulty talking about class today. Instead, they talk about immigrants taking away their jobs, things like that. And certainly both parties have difficulty talking about class. And it ends up sounding sort of like a cultural argument,
yeah,
that the noble miners of West Virginia being attacked by the elites of the East Coast and the West Coast and things like that, when in fact there are much greater class influences on this kind of behavior. Whatever happened to unions in America, for example, makes a huge difference in what happens with the working class. But we don't hear that much about unions these days, even though they were so central to the American economic juggernaut of the 1950s and 1960s.
I want to ask about the conflict that you write about that's going on within religion. It's kind of a clash among believers. And on one hand, I guess you have liberals, theological liberals, people who may not take the Bible, scripture, literally. But then on the other hand, you have this, what you describe as this growing movement of basically fundamentalists. What's going on within religion?
Well, the movement of liberals, or what were also known as modernists, really starts kind of in the wake of The Origin of Species being published in 1859. and was part of this movement that comes out of Germany, which is another story altogether, to reconcile the Bible with modern scholarship, anthropology, archaeology, linguistics, all of these things that, if you want to believe the Bible, should be read literally in the plain language of King James English, which is obviously what God speaks in, then you've got some troubles with that. And so modernist theologians worked out a way to reconcile these things, that they thought that you could hang on to the moral message of the Bible while still ceding some of the literal truth of, for example, the first chapters of Genesis. And it's really not until about 1910, 1915, that you get a powerful counterattack against this from conservative theologians, starting primarily in the North, although we think of this as a Southern thing. And so it was really some conservative Northern Protestants who launched what became known as fundamentalism in and around 1919, that this was a fundamentalist movement to go back to what they thought were the fundamentals of the faith. And they start by trying to purify the churches of these modernist theologians, and eventually they start trying to purify the schools as well. And that's where William Jennings Bryan and the Scopes trial come in.
It's interesting. You mentioned this big conference these fundamentalists gather in Philadelphia in 1919. And basically, you talk about how a lot of their efforts are kind of scattershot. They're looking basically for someone to unify all of this energy. And I guess this is when the idea of William Jennings Bryan emerges.
Right. Bryan was such a central figure at this time. I mean, had run for president unsuccessfully 3 times. Had led the populists actually down a disastrous road. But he was one of the most foremost men in American culture and American politics. And so when you have these scattered crusades and somebody like Bryan decides to pick up leadership of this, all of a sudden you've got a movement. Mm. And Bryan is really central to fusing together these disparate strands of fundamentalism and giving them a focus that they didn't have before. Because prior to Bryan getting involved, it was kind of a lot of conservative Protestants who were concerned about different interpretations of the Bible, were concerned about the status of women, were concerned about liberal modernism, but they didn't really turn towards evolution as the centerpiece until Bryan starts getting involved. Yeah. And for his own reasons, Bryan thought that evolution was right at the heart of liberalism and right at the heart of the decline of evangelical Christianity in the early 20th century. And so with his leadership, all of a sudden, fundamentalists have a megaphone and they have a focus. Mm. And that becomes really central to fundamentalism and, of course, central to anti-evolutionism in the 1920s.
It's interesting the way Bryan sees evolution. He says it has basically 3 great crimes. The fact that it contradicted biblical revelation, that seems fairly obvious, and that's very important to him. But I'm interested in the fact that there were other problems with evolution and Darwin. He said that it also provided a rationale for warfare and that it undercut an impulse for social and political reform. We'll get to the biblical revelation part in a moment. Talk about those other ones that he's worried about.
Well, it's important to note when Bryan really is picking up his crusade against evolution and where it really starts to form is right during and in the wake of World War I.
Yeah.
And Bryan had read some books where authors were saying that Germany's militarism in World War I, in the Great War, was actually caused by their reading of Darwin through reading Nietzsche, who they said was a student of Darwin's, not very accurately. And so Bryan, who had very much opposed the Great War and opposed American involvement as well as, obviously, German involvement, thought that evolution was partly responsible for this kind of cataclysm in world politics and in world history. And so for him, that was pretty central, pretty important, that if you've got something that you can say actually caused the Great War, well, it's kind of your job to stop that from happening in the future.
Yeah.
And at the same time, when he's thinking about domestic politics, you have something that came to be known as social Darwinism, although it wasn't something that Darwin himself had any involvement with. That is, there is a war within society in the struggle for survival. And for Darwin, the struggle for survival is actually a struggle to reproduce more of your children than of somebody else's. But in social Darwinism, it became an argument that the strong are the ones who survive and that the cream rises to the top. And so this was very attractive to the robber barons of the late 19th, early 20th century, and attractive to people who didn't want any kind of social reform. And that struck at the heart of what Bryan was interested in, because Bryan was the major reformer of the late 19th, early 20th century. And he saw Darwinism as being an argument for a war between the strong and the weak, and a rationale for not having to have any kind of social reform at all, not having to help the weak because they were losing in the race for life, so they didn't deserve to be helped. For Bryan, that was a real problem.
Yeah. I think that is an important point because it's easy, I think, to give a caricature to Bryan and his efforts against evolution, but they were really based on some strong moral principles. Put aside the Bible for a moment. He worried. I mean, you mentioned he was a reformer. He championed women's suffrage. He fought against Wall Street, some of the excesses of capitalism. He pushes for the direct election of senators. He's very much interested in democracy. And the involvement of the public. And so those are the moral implications that he sees that could be at stake through Darwinism. That's something I don't think we think a lot about.
Bryan is a difficult figure for us to wrap our minds around today. This combination of religious fervor, religious conservatism that he had, and social reform is not what we consider to be typical of evangelical Protestantism, that we tend to think of evangelical Protestants as being very much on the right side of the political spectrum and opposed to at least social reform of the type that Bryan espoused, and to be more on the side of moral reform and not a particularly enlightened form of moral reform.
Yeah.
And so I think that makes it much more difficult for those of us living in the 21st century to wrap our minds around the complicated figure of William Jennings Bryan and to understand the forces that play into the Scopes trial more generally.
Yeah. Bryan interpreted his political reform, you say, as part of his religious mission. He didn't disconnect the two of those things, I guess.
Right. And there, too, that might resonate with us today, but it seemed kind of a novelty when Americans were looking at Bryan at the time. Bryan himself saw these as intimately connected. And when you look at some of the other large reform movements at the time, you think of something like Prohibition, which really was a reform movement, that was shot right through with religious fervor, and especially the kind of crusading Protestant morality that was so near and dear to Bryan's heart. And there are some others. Getting votes for women was very much of a Protestant evangelical crusade. It was related to the desire for Prohibition, the idea being that if women get the vote, they will vote against the saloon interests. And so for a lot of Americans at the time, religious fervor and Protestant reform went hand in hand. And in that sense, they followed Bryan's example. And Bryan himself did not consider this to be any kind of an inconsistency or any kind of a problem.
Yeah.
Now, critics of his, like H.L. Mencken, a newspaper man from Baltimore, and Hornbeck is the H.L. Mencken character in Inherit the Wind. Mencken thought that he was participating in the rankest kind of hypocrisy. But Mencken was not in favor of reform at all, let alone religious reform.
Yeah.
And so Mencken despised Bryan in general. He said that he was a mountebank and a pretender, and basically said that Bryan realized at some point that he couldn't be the people's president, so he decided to try to become the people's pope. And so Mencken thought that Bryan's just trying to hang on to the adherence of the plain people for whom Mencken himself had nothing but contempt.
Yeah.
And he said, Bryan is popular wherever men are half-wits, that he had a talent for inflaming half-wits. And so you'd think that he could have won a majority in America without a problem. But it turns out that there weren't enough half-wits, even in the 1920s, to elect Bryan.
That's Jeffrey Moran. He's a professor of history at the University of Kansas. Among his books are The Scopes Trial and American Genesis. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In July of 1925, the state of Tennessee put John Thomas Scopes on trial for violating a law against teaching evolution. Today in the program, we're telling the story behind this trial. Our guest is Jeffrey Moran. He's a history professor at the University of Kansas. Before we head into the act that starts the Scopes trial, I want to say something more about Darwin. It's the prime mover of the story, as you say, the origin of the species. And it had been decades since this book first came out when we get to the Scopes trial. But you say, and I found this interesting, it actually hadn't yet found general scientific acceptance. Say something about that.
Well, Origin of Species was published in 1859, and it was fortunate, I guess, or unfortunate for Americans that it was published in English, as indeed Charles Darwin himself was English. And so Darwin's book was able to cross the Atlantic pretty easily, but it had been published quite a while before it really began to cause trouble in America. And when people were first reading it, a lot of American scientists and English scientists had already accepted some form of evolution. They'd accepted that there had been changes over time and that some of the species that they saw today were not the same as they had been centuries or thousands of years earlier. But Darwin's explanation of this, that there was a struggle for survival and that this is what had caused variation in species over time, was something that was novel. And it made a lot of sense to scientists who had their minds open to new explanations for why this would happen. Prior to Darwin, there were Lamarckians who believed that you could kind of create evolutionary changes within a generation or two, that the first giraffes were animals who had started straining their necks to get the low leaves and then the higher leaves on trees. And so long-necked giraffes who had been straining to reach higher would give birth to new creatures who would already have long necks, who in turn would be stretching up to get high leaves. You could think of it, if you were a bodybuilder today, you would give birth, possibly, to muscular babies, and they in turn, if they were bodybuilders, would in turn give birth to even more muscular babies, so that in the end we would have a whole race of Arnold Schwarzeneggers. And this was one of the prime ways of thinking about evolution, if you accepted that there was change over time in the species, and that Darwin's approach made a lot of sense in a way that this older approach of Lamarckism didn't make sense. And so he brought together a lot of these explanations for how there were changes in species. But scientists generally accepted that the Earth was hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years old, and that there had been some changes in species over time. But Darwin really put all of this together in a way that made sense and that had a much greater impact on general ways of interpreting natural history.
When does the attention for this fundamentalist impulse, anti-evolution, when does it turn to the country's public schools?
Evolution starts to be seen as a problem in the public schools at the very moment when public schools are really exploding in membership. Now, this is really what we can trace to the 1920s. There's a demographic shift and a shift in school laws, so that public high schools prior to the 1920s go from a population of about 200,000 students in the nation's high schools to 2 million by the mid-1920s. And this creates all sorts of issues. They become central to the culture, and this is where you begin to get large national disputes over what's going to go into the high schools. Evolution joins, actually, sex education, which is also something that I've published on, as controversies in the public schools. But you have to have a lot of students attending the public schools before you really have a controversy.
Yeah.
And it's not just a coincidence that this is also when you get the Scopes trial, when you get this focus on the problems, the dangers of evolution in the public schools.
Tennessee leads the way. And there's, of course, a bill that gets us to the Scopes trial, an act passed 71-5. Not a lot of dissent for it. John Washington Butler is the one who proposes it. Say what the law does. It even goes further than Brian is comfortable with. But it's so mention this law.
Well, the Butler Law, as proposed by John Washington Butler, as you note, followed Butler's general religious outlook. He was a primitive Baptist, and I don't mean to say that he was a primitive person. That's just a sect of the Baptist theology. And baptism, since it doesn't have a central organizing body, just multiplies sects by the dozens each decade. And Butler was a primitive Baptist, and he became aware that the high schools were beginning to teach something that didn't fit with his theology. And so he proposed this law, making it a misdemeanor for any teacher in public schools to teach something that was opposed to the book of Genesis and instead holds up man as having not been created through divine fiat. Essentially, we would interpret it as making it illegal to teach a scientific evolutionary explanation for where humanity came from.
Yeah.
And this becomes a big part of what the Scopes Trial is arguing about.
Right.
That you need scientists to interpret where man came from, and you need scientists to interpret what evolution means. And John Butler had evolution in the Butler Law, and the American Civil Liberties Union saw the Butler Law as an attack, first of all, on the separation of church and state, which was a growing concept at the time. It wasn't well established, but it was a growing concept. And saw it also as an attack on teachers' rights as labor. And the Civil Liberties Union began as a defense, as basically a defense of unions and a defense of workers' rights. And so for the American Civil Liberties Union, the Butler Law was doubly dangerous. And so they got involved pretty quickly. But as you note, the Tennessee legislature certainly didn't have a problem with the Butler Law.
Right. Right.
That It passed the law almost without discussion. There was a little more discussion when it got to the Senate in Tennessee, but the House in Tennessee voted 71-5 in favor of the Butler Law. And Austin Peay, who was the governor at the time, signed it into law with the kind of understanding that nobody would be fool enough to try to enforce a law whose major purpose was to display the piety of the state legislators, just to prove that they, in fact, believed in Genesis.
Yeah.
And that he didn't think that this law was going to be actually enforced. And it was kind of a surprise to everybody when the town of Dayton tried arresting somebody for violating the Butler Act, and when the state actually pressed onward to try to enforce the Butler Law. And it caught William Jennings Bryan off guard as well.
Right.
It was a misdemeanor. There was a fine for it. Bryan didn't think that there should really be particular enforcement of this. He thought that, you know, you should get in trouble, but he didn't think that you should have to pay a fine the way that John Scopes had to do. And he certainly opposed criminal penalties for this, the way other states suggested. Bryan liked teachers. He didn't think that a teacher should get in real trouble for teaching something that violated the law of the land. He was certainly willing to try to prosecute him, but he was a little uncomfortable with the law as Butler had written it.
It's so interesting the way this case starts to develop, that you write about this, how the ACLU, as you said, they very much took this Butler Act seriously. So they go looking for this test case. They advertise in Tennessee newspapers, in fact. They're looking for a plaintiff, eventually a defendant. And the only response comes, as you say, from Dayton. And John Thomas Scopes, of course, who had, as you put in the book, inherited a strain of unorthodoxy from his father, he doesn't like this Butler Law. He has little to lose, as you say, and he quote-unquote confesses to state authorities. But I'm trying to figure out, did he actually even teach evolution in his class, or did he just want to come along and be a defendant in an important test case?
Whether Scopes had actually taught about evolution in his class, he was, after all, not the regular biology teacher,
right?
Even. He had stepped in. I think he probably did for this reason. The actually state-adopted biology textbook that was being used in the Dayton public schools and indeed throughout Tennessee had a pretty decent explanation of evolution and actually used what sometimes we could refer to as the E word all the time. And so I think the preponderance of evidence is that he probably did at least mention it and mention something like the Big Bang as well.
Mm-hmm.
And his students, who didn't want him to get in trouble, did testify that he taught something like this. But you're right that the jury is kind of out on whether he actually taught about it, and it was clear that he didn't make a big show of teaching it. But he was kind of invited to stand up as part of this test case by the town fathers and the town brothers of Dayton, Tennessee. You know, it's one of these problems with test cases that you actually have to have a human stand in and launch the case. And so the ACLU couldn't just sue on its own. It needed to have an actual defendant. Mm-hmm. And so people in Dayton decided, well, you know, this might be good publicity for us. John, you've got nothing to lose. Why don't you stand for this and we'll just all agree that you taught this? And so some of his friends actually arrested him and put him on trial. And they were excited because Dayton is a small town in a remote part of Tennessee. And this was their chance, as they said, to get on the map.
Right.
Now, they didn't know what this map was going to look at, but they were very excited.
No, it backfired on them, didn't it?
Yeah, they thought that Dayton would finally make its name, but they didn't expect that this name would become what we think of it today is basically a synonym for bigotry and intolerance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you have to feel a little badly for them at the time that, you know, when you go looking for publicity, they didn't really get the kind of publicity that they wanted. Although every year there is still a Scopes trial day mm-hmm. down in Tennessee. And certainly on 25th, 50th, and 100th anniversaries, a lot of people head down there to celebrate or to mourn, I suppose, the Scopes trial.
I guess the idea is that this was supposed to be a more of a kind of a public debate than an actual criminal proceeding. But then you have all of these players, Clarence Darrow, of course, and William Jennings Bryan, who have their own agendas. Darrow brings his own baggage to this trial. He wants this to be an opportunity to attack religion on one hand. And it's interesting how the ACLU keeps trying to kind of maneuvering him out of the way. They didn't really want it to be that way. And I don't know if people wanted William Jennings Bryan to declare that this is a really all about whether or not there is a God. It seems like it kind of spun out of control in some ways. Is that fair to say?
I think that's right. Part of the problem for the prosecution, for Bryan and his allies, is they did want it to be kind of a public discussion. But in the trial, they themselves couldn't actually get any decent experts. The number of reputable scientists who were willing to testify in the trial that evolution was malarkey was really quite small. And so instead, Bryan and his team decided that they would try to get rid of expert testimony altogether.
Yeah, right.
And Bryan, I think, was a little embarrassed by this eventually. But for Darrow and the ACLU, this was a crisis because their whole case was going to depend on having experts, really reputable experts from Johns Hopkins, from Harvard and elsewhere, to testify about the difficulty of interpreting the Bible and to testify about the validity of evolutionary theory. And so what you get is the prosecution and the defense, when they're not in the courtroom, they're sort of making speeches outside of the courtroom. Mm-hmm. They're holding rallies on the lawns outside the courthouse and traveling around to Nashville and Chattanooga and elsewhere, Bryan especially, and giving kind of pep rallies and tent revivals during this time. And Bryan in particular started proclaiming that this trial was going to be a duel to the death between religion and science. And Bryan didn't really think that science was the devil in this case, but he thought that evolution was a real problem.
Right.
And so he was willing to say that this was going to be a great public duel. And Darrow had been raised on this tradition of small-town skepticism, and he was a self-proclaimed agnostic. And he was only too happy to make a public show of this as well. And so he was very happy to fight Bryan every step of the way and fight Bryan's what Darrow considered to be very narrow interpretation of religion. Darrow was, although an agnostic, he was willing to accept Christianity for what it could do, but he was not willing to accept fundamentalist Christianity. He wasn't willing to accept so-called literal reading of the Bible.
Jeffrey Moran is an historian and a professor of history at the University of Kansas. He's the author of the book American Genesis, The Evolution Controversies from Scopes to Creation Science. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Scopes trial. We return now to our conversation with Professor Jeffrey Moran. Let's hear from Brian and Darrow as they make their central cases. This is from a dramatization of the trial that plays out. This was an L.A. Theater Works production from several years ago, The Great Tennessee Monkey Trials. Edward Asner plays William Jennings Bryan in this production. And let's play a moment of this as he makes his case.
They do not explain the great riddle of the universe. They do not deal with the problems of life. They do not teach the great science of how to live. There is no place for miracles in this train of evolution. They eliminate everything supernatural from the Old Testament as well as the New. They eliminate the virgin birth, the resurrection of the body, and with it the doctrine of atonement. They don't tell us in this long period of time between the cell and man where man became endowed with the hope of immortality.
It's sad, isn't it, that we don't have an actual recording of this trial, even though it was broadcast?
It was the first radio network was set up, WGN in Chicago, was set up to broadcast the Scopes trial to waiting listeners in Chicago and elsewhere. And yet, you're right, we don't actually have Brian's voice. We don't actually have Darrow's voice. I maintain the hope that somebody will discover newsreel footage somewhere because there were cameramen in the crowd, and certainly the judge posed for them regularly during the trial.
Right.
But I'll say Ed Asner does a great job.
Yeah, he does.
He sounds like my image of William Jennings Bryan would sound. Mm. I should put in a kind of local plug. Ed Asner is a native Kansan. And so given Kansas's mixed record on accepting evolution, Ed Asner would fit in pretty well as the voice of William Jennings Bryan.
Yeah. On the second day of the trial, you in your book, you write about how Darrow starts attacking the constitutionality of this Butler Act, calls it foolish and calls it wicked. And he says by imposing a fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible into the law, the act violates restrictions against, you know, religious legislation. And he says it makes the Bible the yardstick to measure every man's intellect. Let's hear a little bit about from Charles Darrow. This is read by the actor John DeLancey in that production, The Great Tennessee Monkey Trials.
If today you can take a thing like evolution and make it a crime to teach it in the public schools, tomorrow you can make it a crime to teach it in the private schools, and then in the hustings or in church. At the next session, you can ban books and newspapers. If you can do one, you can do the other. And after a while, Your Honor, it is the setting of man against man and creed against creed, until with flying banners and beating drums, we are marching backwards into the 16th century, when bigots burned the men who dared to bring any intelligence, enlightenment, and culture to the human mind.
You say the court broke into applause. Even they were trying to be restrained, I guess it would be hard not to with such a speech.
It's not just that the courtroom wanted to be restrained. They disagreed with Darrow.
Right.
The jurymen and people attending this were, after all, Tennesseans and Daytonians. And they wanted to agree with William Jennings Bryan. They agreed with William Jennings Bryan. But this was still a great time of oratory. And when you could hear somebody wind it up like Darrow was doing, and you get a sense of why Darrow was such a powerful attorney in the 1920s, when they could hear somebody wind it up like that, they couldn't help themselves. They broke out into applause and cheered. And there was another great speech given during the trial by Darrow's colleague, Dudley Field Malone, which was louder than Bryan and a magnificent speech. And Bryan, in fact, after it said, "Dudley, that was the greatest speech I've ever heard in my life." And there on the transcript itself, it said, "loud and sustained applause in parentheses after Malone's speech. But yeah, Darrow had a way with words, and sometimes it got him in trouble, but more often he could save people from the electric chair, and he could bring the crowd to its feet when he needed to. He was not unlike Brian in that sense.
Yeah. So Darrow, as you say, tries to call scientists to the stand, and it's a big part of this story that the judge rules against it. He's not able to do that. And so at what point, and let's talk about the seventh day, at what point does Clarence Darrow decide he's going to call William Jennings Bryan to the stand? Was it a surprise?
The judge was certainly surprised. Everybody was surprised. So for background, as I had said earlier, the prosecution realized it didn't have any experts of its own, that all of the scientists were going to say that evolution is true. And so they decided to argue that you didn't need experts, that the defense shouldn't be allowed to call experts as well. And the judge ruled that the prosecution was right, that you shouldn't be allowed to have expert testimony. This left the defense without its major weapons. And so what dawned upon Darrow as the trial went on, I think probably on the fifth day, was that there was, as he said, really only one expert on the Bible left in the courtroom, and that was William Jennings Bryan himself. And so he called Bryan to the stand as an unfriendly witness, as a hostile witness. And then this is the jaw-dropping moment. Bryan accepted the challenge.
Yeah.
Now, why you would accept a challenge from the greatest attorney in the country to be grilled by him is a mystery to me. But for Bryan, I think he really wanted it to be a trial between religion and science. I think he also felt a little badly for the defense because Bryan had been calling this the duel of the century, and he had not allowed, his team had not allowed it to become any kind of duel at all.
Right.
And one of Darrow's colleagues said, you know, it's not a duel if we are simply strapped to the table and have our sword taken away. And I think he shamed Bryan into agreeing to go up there. And Bryan, of course, had his own enormous ego. And so he said, yeah, I have nothing to fear. And for Bryan, as long as he was talking to people who agreed with him, he was a wonderful speaker and the smartest man in the room. But it turned out not to be such a good idea to expose himself to close questioning of his religious understanding.
Let's play a moment of this. This is, of course, a part of Darrow's cross-examination of Bryan. We'll hear again from John DeLancey as Clarence Darrow and Ed Asner as Bryan.
Mr. Bryan, do you believe that the first woman was Eve?
Yes.
Do you believe that she was literally made out of Adam's rib?
I do.
Did you ever discover where Cain, Adam and Eve's son, got his wife?
No, sir. I leave the agnostics to hunt for her.
All right. Does the statement the morning and evening of the first day and the morning and evening of the second day mean anything to you?
I do not think it necessarily means a 24-hour day.
Really? Well, you don't, huh?
No.
What do you consider it to be?
I have not attempted to explain it. The word day is used to describe a whole period of creation. Therefore, I do not see there is necessity for construing the words evening and the morning as meaning necessarily a 24-hour day.
Does it or doesn't it?
Right, many people think so.
Well, what do you think?
I do not think it does.
You think those were not literal days?
I do not think that they were 24-hour days.
I see.
No, but I think it would be just as easy for the kind of God we believe in to make the earth in 6 days, or in 6 years, or in 6 million years, or in 600 million years. I do not think it important whether we believe one or the other.
It's interesting about this exchange that Bryan admits parts of the Bible don't need to be accepted literally necessarily. But so that causes some damage. But you say the most damaging part of this was his, as you put it, his repeated confessions of ignorance about science and theology, for that matter. Say something about that.
Brian was in a tough position. He was trying so hard not to make a mistake, not to give ammunition to the defense, to Darrow, that he was stuck kind of reciting over and over, no matter what the question, that I believe it how the Bible is written. It's right there in the Bible. And so he ended up sounding like he just didn't know anything about the Bible. And partly because if he spent more time talking about interpretation of the Bible, he would find himself in the position, as we just heard, of actually trying to make some sort of interpretation of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we're back to the whole problem that you need experts to testify about what the Bible means and to testify about what evolution actually means. So Darrow kept pressing him on the extravagant miracles that we see in the Old Testament, a big fish or a whale swallowing Jonah, Joshua commanding the sun to stand still, things like that. He avoided questions about the divinity of Jesus and things like that, but forced Brian to defend these things that were really contrary to common sense and certainly to common scientific understanding. And he also had to note that he didn't know very much about the ages of civilization, that he didn't know very much about other interpretations of the Bible. And so he came out of this questioning on the seventh day just looking like a guy who didn't know very much about anything. Now, Brian's admission, which is what Darrow pounces on, that the days of Genesis might be thousands of years, might be millions of years each, was actually a pretty standard fundamentalist way of reconciling Genesis with our understanding of the age of the earth. But it looked very much like what it was, which is an interpretation of the Bible, something that departs from the literal meaning of the Bible. In fact, creationists today, anti-evolutionists today, think that that was one of the reasons that Brian did poorly in the Scopes trial, that he wasn't enough of a fundamentalist, and that that's why he looked bad. But Darrow and his allies and a lot of the newspaper men of the time, and they were men, I'm afraid, all thought that this was part and parcel of Brian's ignorance and part and parcel of his narrow view of the world.
You have written that the Scopes trial cannot be simplistically connected to recent controversies. So I'll be careful with this question, because I do wonder, finally, if you think you see in that story from 1925 any connections to the cultural tensions we see today. Are you drawing any parallels at all? Do you see any of it?
There are parallels with the cultural tensions that anti-evolution was responding to in the 1920s and some of what we see today. Starting in the 1980s, you get intelligent design, which is kind of the newfangled approach to creationism, justifying itself in kind of in-house memoranda as being opposed to atheism, opposed to crime, opposed to prostitution, and opposed to rock and roll music, really seeing themselves, the intelligent designers, seeing themselves as crusaders against cultural liberalism and cultural indecency. And so for a while, there actually was a connection or collaboration between the new right that we'd see with the Moral Majority and elsewhere and creationists, that they saw themselves as being on the same side of the culture wars. Now, when really pushed, the cultural warriors, focus on the family, the Moral Majority, other groups, were willing to jettison creationism when necessary. But the creationists really felt that they were in cahoots with the Moral Majority, that they were really serving the purposes of cultural conservatives in modern America. And they thought that our society was going to hell in a handbasket, the same way that Brian and others thought that that was true in the 1920s, and that evolution played a big role in this. So I think today there is less of a sense of cultural crisis than there was in the 1920s, just because we had lived through the 1920s, and we had lived through the 1960s. But there is still some of that sense of cultural crisis that runs through publications from creationist groups. And it's less militant than the 1920s, but it's still very much there.
Jeffrey Moran teaches modern U.S. history at the University of Kansas. He's the author of a number of books, among them The Scopes Trial. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Zoe Wolf-McGinn. We had technical direction from Adrian Moranville. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Eileen Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.